You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to help you plan that unbelievable travel experience. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
For decades, milk has been fueling women marathon runners as the OG performance drink. And in the new docuseries Running Sucks, brought to you by Team Milk, Abby Ayers takes us on a journey of self-discovery as she meets several groups of empowered women runners to find out what drives them, what fuels them, and what pushes them to go the distance. And in the process, she learns that she too can be a distance runner. You can watch the series at runningsucktheseries.com and register for the inaugural Every Woman's Marathon at everywomansmarathon.com.
Hey, it's the Long Form Podcast. Here's Max Linsky. Here's Evan Ratliff. And I'm Aaron Lammer, your co-host. Welcome, guys.
So good to see you guys.
It's great.
It's awkward whether you should use co in front of a lot of words in this context, I feel like.
Where have you landed?
I've been co-ing it because I don't want to offend anyone. I don't want you guys to think that I'm muscling in, making a power play on this show.
Well, you can try it. Do you want to do it again, see if, how it feels?
I'm your host, Aaron Lammer. This week I talked to Alice Gregory. Alice Gregory is a writer for N Plus One. She's written for GQ, Harper's. I think her most recent piece was a profile of Ryan McGinley in the current GQ. But I really, really admire the way that she describes people, particularly at a sentence level. And I think she's a really interesting interview.
So. Yeah, such good sentences.
She's a good interviewer too. She's got a good two-way interview spirit.
She turned it around on you?
Yeah, she kept me on my heels. Do we have any sponsors this week?
Yeah, I was just about to say. You may be on your heels pretty often because our sponsor this week is EA Sports FIFA World Cup. It's the latest version of their incredible soccer game, which we are completely addicted to in this office. We've transitioned seamlessly from FIFA 14 to World Cup. It's great. We've got copies to give away, too. So email editors@longform.org. First 10 people get a free copy of the game.
If you're trying to keep in touch with more than 10 people, probably you want to stop group emailing them and start an email newsletter. There's no better place to do it than with Tiny Letter. It's simple. It's powerful. It's from the good people at MailChimp. I recommend it.
And here's Aaron with Alice Gregory.
Welcome, Alice Gregory.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming on in. You've actually written, like, you pop up as a character in your pieces enough that I have, like, some outline of the last 5 years or so of your life. But filling in those details, what sort of a path have you followed as a writer, like, from college to where you are right now?
So I feel like I did college incorrectly. I feel like I treated college as though I were definitely going to go to grad school after college, which in retrospect is insane to me, and I have zero interest in grad school, would never go, don't know what I was thinking. So I didn't really write for the school paper while I was there. I wrote a few like art reviews and book reviews, but not really anything major. I always had a blog. I graduated from college, had a job, like an office job for about a year at Sotheby's, which I wrote about in a piece.
That was where I picked up your trace.
Yeah. Well, that's where it all started, kind of.
So the first thing that catches my ear there, me and you are like different in age, but not a full decade different in age. Like people weren't blogging when I was in college.
Right.
People started blogging like when I moved to New York. I may be 5 to 10 years ahead there. So when you say you were blogging in college, was that like a sort of a testing ground for the kind of writing you actually are doing now?
Ugh, I don't know. I mean, that's a password protected blog. I think it was from Blogspot or Blogger or whatever it was called. And I would never look at it ever again. But no, it was just, you know, musings.
Yeah.
It was not in any sense pre-professional.
But did you ambitions as a writer at that
point?
Yeah,
I did. Though I wasn't really doing anything in college to make them a reality, I think, again, because I was just treating my academic work as though it were the main thing.
What were you thinking you would go to grad school for?
English, I guess.
Yeah. So you graduated and you got a job at Sotheby's. Were you picturing a life of sort of like writing on the side there or like?
No, well, that was just I needed a job and it always felt very temporary to me.
Yeah.
I graduated in 2009 and worked there for about a year. And I remember I quit when I had $1,000 saved up. That was like, I felt very comfortable quitting. That felt like plenty of money to me. And I think the same week I quit that job, or maybe a week later, I published a piece online for N+1 that was about the internet and feelings about the internet, which I think is a very popular topic.
Yeah, the human experience of living in an age of disconnection.
Yeah. So now that I think about it, it was a very smart first move. It got a lot of attention because of the subject matter, and that led to subsequent writing jobs and gigs. And
I was surprised when I went back and read the piece. The piece is sad as hell. We'll link to it in the show notes. That it's actually a review of a Gary Steingart novel, which I remembered.
Yeah, I forget that too.
In taking that, that I assume it was assigned.
How was it? I wrote something on my blog, and Carla, an editor there, asked if I wanted to expand it into a piece.
It's a pretty expansive review. More than half of it is not about the book. But what do you think that this sort of, I mean, it was a piece that I've had emailed to me like 5 or 6 times, which tells me it's being like widely circulated. What about that piece do you feel like made it have that sort of life?
Well, it's funny to think about it now because I think, you know, like any piece about the internet, it feels super dated. I mean, yeah. I haven't read it since then, but I can't imagine it feeling at all relevant or not very naive and kind of 50-year-old guy writing an op-ed sort of style. I think everyone has a sense that what they do on a computer is private. So when there is someone who writes about it in a way that explains that it's actually the shared experience, and, you know, in the same way that a novel that kind of will describe a very specific thing that everyone thinks only they experience as universal, that's kind of what people like in novels. And that's kind of the danger of reading too many books set in New York, I think. You can get that sort of satisfaction from pretty minor, superficial details. But when it comes to the internet, I think that's kind of what people glom onto.
There's a strange feeling of hearing someone for the first time sort of describe the isolation and alienation of the internet. And I agree, looking back, it seems, I wouldn't say cliche, but it seems like...
Yeah, it seems cliche.
it seems like strikingly like universal and sort of obvious, but I think that it's difficult to actually zoom back and realize that there was a period a few years ago where, you know, the iPhone is only, 5 years old. Like, this sort of constant connectivity was actually like a novel human experience.
Yeah, I didn't even have an iPhone for a full year before I wrote that.
That's something that's hard to capture about the modern world, which is that we're in this period of like intense zoom forward, and sort of we keep recalculating what the human experience around this stuff is. And when we write about it, I think we very neatly become sort of cheerleaders or scolds for the sort of techno future. And there isn't a lot of like, what does this feel like? Or like, you know, what is the common experience with this? So what did that piece lead to for you?
Well, I think I always think about it like the shoe bomber thing. You know, you write something that people like, and then they want to assign you the exact same thing.
What does that have to do with shoe bombing?
You know, like now we all have to take off our shoes.
Oh, okay.
Right?
You bomb one airplane, you got to bomb another.
In the exact same way. So yeah. There was, yeah, a lot of, you know, editors asking if I wanted to write about how I felt about other kinds of technology, which I didn't really. But it was, I mean, I can't complain. It was like the best first assignment to have, and that kind of just led to everything else.
Once you quit that job with $1,000 in your bank account, what was your next? I mean, how did you move from that towards writing more pieces and writing on a sort of more regular schedule?
I mean, it just all kind of snowballed slowly. I mean, I was pitching stuff. I mean, I feel like it's always, I wish I had some kind of, it would be cool to see the percentage of stuff I write that's pitches versus assignments. I always just assume and say it's 50-50, but I don't know if that's true or not.
Were you worried that you weren't going to get stuff out there, or that people weren't going to accept these pitches when they zoomed out of the techno?
No, I should have been, but yeah. I wasn't. I mean, I don't think that's like not a move anyone over 22 would ever make, thinking that it's cool to quit a job with $1,000 in the world and everything will be fine.
It seems like most people who are trying to, like, the first year they're trying to make a living writing, you're like, there's a lot in the kitchen sink. There's a lot of like different kinds of stuff. Did you think, I need to do this many pieces to pay my rent? I need to put out this many pitches?
I mean, for me, it was just accepting everything, pitching as much as I could, writing all the time. It wasn't really a calculation. It was a pretty simple calculation. It was just do as much as you can.
I think one of the next pieces you did was that Sotheby's piece for N+1.
Mm-hmm.
This piece about Sotheby's is, I would say, not entirely flattering to the Sotheby's franchise.
No.
Were you worried about mining your own experience so early in that kind of way?
I wouldn't put it that way. I mean, I was definitely nervous that there would be some sort of maybe even legal repercussions.
Yeah.
And so I was like very sure that N+1's lawyer went over it, though I ended up hearing nothing from them, which makes sense. I mean,
yeah, they're like N+1.
N+1. Who cares? For me, that was the way that I made that year worth it.
You have a way in pieces, and there's another piece I want to talk about that's also from N+1 about Mavericks, which is a surf break, of turning a real experience you've had in a real place and that's very sort of firmly located into sort of a larger discussion, in the case of the Sotheby's piece, about beauty and art and commerce and the sort of intersection of these larger ideas. You sort of introduce the scene through your own experiences, but really that piece about Sotheby's is a lot about what the relationship of the ultra rich to art is, and what the sort of performance of the auction house means for it. Is that a conscious technique on your part? And like, how did you, when you said, I want to write about Sotheby's, my experience, do you start with the experience or do you start with the larger idea of what you want to talk about?
Oh, I definitely start with the experience. I feel like I write most things, even things that don't appear in the first person. Often I start them in the first person,
mm-hmm.
and then we'll switch tenses. You know, I'll just edit it so it's in the third person. I guess I just don't trust that my own experience as pure account is necessarily interesting or worth it. I feel like you need to do some sort of theoretical or imaginative or conceptual leap to be of any value.
Let's take that that piece, Mavericks. Mavericks is about a surf break in Northern California, where I am also from. I'm from Berkeley.
Mm-hmm.
Where
I'm from
you?
Marin.
Marin. Okay, we're close. So the piece is about a surf competition in Mavericks, but it's really much more about the experience of watching a surf competition. Do you know, like, when you're setting out to go to Mavericks, do you know I'm going to turn this into a piece?
In that case, yes, definitely. I had been wanting to go to Mavericks, that surf competition, my whole life, basically. And for whatever reason, I just hadn't. It's not held every year because of the weather, the conditions. So I saw, I think a few days before I ended up flying out, I saw that on San Francisco Chronicle's website that, you know, the announcement that it was on this year.
Yeah.
So I bought a plane ticket, and it was the first and only, to this date, piece I've ever written on spec. I just kind of had a sense that it would be a good story. There wouldn't be any other people from New York out there. Because of my own biography, I'd be good at telling it. So I bought a plane ticket and flew out there. And so it had to be a piece. I mean, I bought a plane ticket and went there. It couldn't have just very well seen it and flown home, you know.
It's not getting written off in the budget. So you show up at Mavericks, you take the flight, you rent a car, you go out there. The whole competition takes place in one day, I think, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you've got to get the meat of this piece, you know. You got to get a few good details per hour. What's your strategy? Like, when you show up somewhere like that and you're like, I need, this is on spec, it's got to pay for itself. What do you do first? I mean, what are you doing at this competition?
I have a notebook out the entire time, and I'm writing down everything I see, but I'm also crossing things out. So I'll witness something and then within 10 seconds realize that that's not an important detail at all and be embarrassed that I wrote it down.
And then you cross it off.
Like, don't even type that up.
Why cross it off?
Just to save time. I write everything down in a notebook and then I'll type it up into a document once I get home to my computer. And you can very easily spend many hours just typing up notes that aren't important.
What are the notes on? Like what catches your eye?
What people are wearing, how people talk, what people look like, how they look different than people in New York, that's kind of the population I'm used to people watching. The ways in which the surfers kind of held themselves in a way that was different than a normal civilian.
Yeah, actually, there was a phrase there, like, surfers have a kind of compromised grace. I really like that turn of phrase. Are you writing, like, down, it's awkward taking off a wetsuit, but they're somehow graceful? Or, like, when you say something like that, that's a very specific and I think quite beautiful way of describing them. Is the writing being recorded in your notes, or are you recording something that you need to turn into writing?
It's usually recording things that need to be turned into writing, though sometimes like a phrase will pop up or someone will say something that will remind me that I definitely need to write it down this way. For the most part, it is turned into writing, though, once I get home.
When there's a time pressure like that, is that like a desperate exercise, like scribbling this stuff down?
Yeah.
Is that a skill that you've developed over time?
I definitely take less notes than I used to.
Yeah, I'm interested because I get the notes that you're the first person I've ever heard say you cross out notes. Is that something that you learned after doing this a few times?
Yeah, I mean, my least favorite thing, kind of the most immature mistake that I tend to make or that I notice in other people's writing that I hate, is kind of the inconsequential, like, fake detail that is supposed to telegraph something but actually doesn't.
You can only include details if you get them, so that there's a certain hoarder's instinct to hoard detail. But I think the taking away of detail and the sort of misleading detail or the superfluous detail is sort of a more gray area. When you look back at pieces, do you say, like, that one I should have, like, let go of? Or
oh, yeah. I mean, I'd never reread anything, and I just... The idea just nauseates me. I would never. I mean,
because it's also in the context of this surfing piece, and I really like this piece, so I'm going to harp on it a bit. But you describe the international surf competition, which Mavericks is ostensibly like one of the like great breaks of. You probably dedicate like maybe a paragraph or two to the like competitive surf element.
Mm-hmm.
Like if you were writing this for a surf magazine, that would be like, what the fuck.
Right.
Like, this is not a very good way to learn about surfing competitions. So do you gather, like, do you go and research the competition? Do you gather a bunch of information and then reject it?
Yeah, for sure. With the surf competition, I mean, one strange thing about writing that was that what I was trying to do structurally was indicate how anticlimactic the actual competition was. Like, mm-hmm. That would have been such a boring article to read if it were actually centered around the surf competition, which no one can see, the people are too far away. There's kind of no real-time adding up of scores. It's just not a good event. It's not a good sport to view. I suspected that would be the case, but I didn't quite realize it until I got there. And there was a certain point where I was like, okay, just forget about trying to document what this competition is, technically, because that's just going to be so boring to read about.
And then you also don't have a lot of interpersonal interactions in it. There's no like, hey, bro, like we were at the like Sierra Nevada 10. It was crazy. Like I think in the entire piece, only one person speaks to you. And that's a sort of an unwelcome intrusion.
Mm-hmm.
Did you just say, hey, I don't think the people are really going to help me tell this story? Or do you find that not talking to people is a sort of a strategic move there?
I think in this case, not talking was definitely a strategic move. I mean, I did talk to people and interview mm-hmm. people and take notes that I didn't include. But I feel like that piece, it could have easily been written in a more straightforward kind of sports journalism way with quotes that are introduced and, you know, you explain who this guy is and how old he is and where he's from and what his credentials as a surfer are. It just didn't feel like that kind of piece to me. I mean, I think mostly because it did not have an inherent plot to it.
Right.
So it felt kind of silly to be giving it all the trappings of a real story.
Hey, it's Max. I'm going to interrupt Aaron and Alice for just a second and tell you a little bit about our sponsor this week. It's EA Sports FIFA World Cup. That is the latest in the FIFA line from EA Sports. the video game to which we are completely addicted in this office. They've got the new one out, and we are playing it all the time. We have transitioned seamlessly from FIFA 14 to World Cup. You should do the same, and you may not even have to pay for it. If you email editors@longform.org, that's editors@longform.org, the first 10 people who do that and put World Cup in the subject line, we'll get a free copy of EA Sports FIFA World Cup. I will go to the post office. I will put it into an envelope and mail it to your house. Pretty good deal. Thanks very much to EA Sports for sponsoring us. And let's get back to Alice and Aaron.
I mean, I definitely get the idea of it being sort of an anti-sports story, say. But once you sort of move outside of the template, the sports story, and you're like, I'm going to do the anti-sports story, there's not like a reverse template for right. doing the opposite. The person who interrupts you in the story is like an old boss mm-hmm. from a surf shop you worked at high school. And then the pace sort of turns 90 degrees and you describe working at that surf shop in pretty good depth. When a lot of people are on this show and they're like, yeah, I was on assignment and I wrote 25,000 words and I have to get it down to 4,000 words. And it's like, well, if you're making that, you're probably not keeping the 5 paragraphs about your high school job. So how do you justify keeping those 5 paragraphs to yourself? And how do you build a template out of a non-template?
Well, I mean, in this case, I feel like if you don't have a real story with a beginning, middle, and an end, you owe it to the reader to kind of serve as their chaperone. And in this case, you know, I knew I was writing for an audience of people that probably didn't know anything about surfing, didn't particularly care about surfing. I mean, I kind of had to, why am I telling this story as opposed to someone else, and why are you reading it? I think I needed to justify my own credentials.
And how do you? Like, why are you a good person to tell that story?
Because I grew up surfing, and I think I was able to appreciate things about it and make fun of it in specific ways and see what's funny about it while still remaining kind of reverent.
What kind of reaction do you get to a piece like that from like someone within the surf world?
The reactions to that piece were actually totally positive. There was nothing bad, which I was happy about. I think I was pretty flattering. You know, I mean, of course, there were a few funny kind of snarky observations. But also, I mean, who knows who read that piece?
We got one email.
Yeah.
You have a piece in the, I guess it's probably the new GQ right now, maybe?
Yeah, someone told me today that it's out.
It's out today, okay. Yeah. You have a piece on Ryan McGinley, who, it's pretty hard to introduce who Ryan McGinley is. He is a celebrity.
Yeah.
But if you live in New York and are between the ages of 20 and 40, you probably know him very well. And if you don't give a shit about art or like any other kind of person, he's not like a household name.
Right.
He is a photographer. I guess I probably saw his stuff like in Vice magazine first part. And his aesthetic is very like linked to the sort of nights of drunken debauchery, captured, you know, people climbing on rooftops and that kind of thing. But in approaching this piece, which is like, it's a real profile. Like it's a profile the way you would profile a rock star he's a person who has such a charged sort of, is this guy cool or is he full of shit kind of element that you have to address that in a piece about him. When did that piece get assigned to you, and what was your sort of like initial tact on it?
The piece got assigned to me maybe even just a week before I went down to Miami, which is a scene in the piece, to go down to the art fair and spend time with him. My initial, I ended up, I think, in the way that one always does, you become much more affectionate towards the subject as mm-hmm. you spend time with them. I was definitely much more skeptical at first than I was when I left.
Someone who has so much sort of baggage, right?
Yeah,
and I'm overdoing that.
No.
But it's sort of like if you were doing a profile of Lena Dunham, or you were doing a profile of Arcade Fire. They're these sort of cultural signifiers that are already larger than themselves, and to not address that is to sort of not address one of the central elements of
the central
element. Yeah. And it's not like they're unaware that there are like people writing about them on message boards and people sort of gossiping about them. So how do you approach profiling someone who has that quality?
Well, again, I think you do need to address it head on. I mean, that is the central tension of the piece. Mm-hmm. Is this guy for real or not? I find his work really, really beautiful. And I was happy to, I mean, I always found it beautiful, but you can find something beautiful and not think it's good. And I do think it's good. And I was glad to think it was good. It would have been a lot harder, or it would have been a lot easier to write the profile had I just thought this guy was, you know, a total clown.
Is that a weird tension, though, where, like, do you have to disguise your opinions like that? Or is that sort of an acceptable thing for the reader to know?
Well, I mean, I'm pretty frank about it in the piece, I think. I think it's an acceptable. To write that piece for a totally general interest magazine like GQ is kind of an odd phenomenon, right? Like, that profile will be really different in different outlets. I mean, any profile is. But I think there's a lot of places that profile could have appeared.
Well, certainly in Art Forum, it's a very different story than GQ.
Yeah. Or even just like a profile that whose reader or a publication whose readers are on the same page as you necessarily, and you know going into it you're going to have to defend your opinion in a certain way. I mean, there was like a lot of responsibility in that piece to just explain who this guy is.
Right.
Kind of in a very objective way.
With a limited amount of space.
Right.
I mean, that's what I find fascinating is the tension between explaining who someone is, explaining what other people thinking about them, and then sort of subverting that whole thing and getting somewhere new.
Well,
once you've established the sort of terrain, how do you inject something that's sort of unique into it? So someone who maybe does know who he is or is interested, they're like feeling like they're sort of cutting through that.
Well, I mean, I think in this particular case, it was a moment I lucked out in the sense that one of the times we met, he had just been kicked off Instagram, which is in the piece. And I'm really glad that happened because that was kind of my way into this whole other theory about him as this guy who is kind of preempted our collective aesthetic of what is cool. And I think that is something that once you say it is very obvious about him, extremely obvious, the most obvious thing about him, but it still does bear repeating, I think. And I think Instagram was kind of what signaled it to me and what would signal it to the reader. I mean, what people think of Instagram photos looking like, that is what Ryan McGinley photos looked like 10 or 15 years ago.
Yeah, I mean, you make an interesting point there in the piece that his aesthetic has become sort of so indistinguishable from both forms of personal expression like Instagram and also like Converse advertisement,
right,
that there's sort of a collective chicken and the egg, like, wow, does this guy's art look like a Converse advertisement or does Converse advertisements look like this? When you're doing a piece like this for GQ, which you described as a general interest magazine, other people might describe as a dudes magazine, is there an established GQ tone? I mean, is there this is how we generally do artist profiles? How much sort of guidance are you given on how to do a piece like this?
I wasn't given any guidance. I've written a piece for a men's magazine in the past that definitely was, you know, punched up.
Yeah.
In a way that I would have been like just physically incapable of doing, like these words would have never occurred to me to even say.
What is the punching process like?
You know, like referring to balls or something. Like I don't like I just like whatever. Like I would never say. But no, GQ was not like that at all. I mean, the editing was mostly structural.
You open the piece with a description of McGinley's wrangler bringing in a series of models who jump on trampolines and perform various sort of dances in front of him while he photographs it. And then you very quickly say, and I was there watching them all, like I'm the fourth person here. So you set up this sort of tableau where there's a stranger watching a stranger watching a stranger who's naked.
Right. Who's naked? <That's laughs>
Well, my first question there is, like, what does it mean to break the fourth wall, like, so declaratively and so, like, openly, like, at the beginning of an article like that?
Well, in that case, I think it was just a matter of, it said a lot to me that I was there and it was no big deal that I was there and that it was just taken as a matter of course, that of course there's a reporter here and of course she's taking notes and of course she's looking at you naked and, you know, tapping into her phone and even drawing things. You know, I mean, the fact that that was just not even addressed, that seemed important to me about the way he works and the kind of guy he is and the sort of kind of blasé attitude he has towards things that necessarily either makes people comfortable or makes people forces people to pretend that they're comfortable.
In the case of McGinley, one of the things that he stresses about his own work is that the importance of sort of having a crew and having the sort of extended family that really the work isn't really made by an auteur so much as a bunch of people all sort of contributing. In your interviewing process for this story, did you do you branch out beyond McGinley? Like, are you talking to the wrangler, talking to the models?
Yeah, I mean, I talked to a lot of people off the record, a lot of models off the record.
Why off the record rather than on the record?
Oh, a lot of them just didn't want to be included in the piece. I don't know if he would say he's not the auteur. I mean, he definitely, I think he is. He just has, you know, he is the director to this photograph as a director is to a film, and then they have crews that actually, I mean, they look very spontaneous, these photographs, but they're not, and he does not pretend that they are anything other than the product of a lot of logistical work. I mean, I was mostly interested in watching him work and hearing what he had to say and observing myself. I mean, I trusted myself and I trusted my experience of him.
Yeah. How do you observe yourself? I think that's an interesting phrase. What does that feel like to observe yourself and how do you think about it?
For me, it just feels so much more honest. Again, like, why are you reading this person talk about, like, why would we ever pretend that there's not someone writing this? Clearly there is. And clearly this person is seeing things that someone else wouldn't see, not seeing things that someone else would see. So I always just feel like I owe it to the reader to make the conditions of the article very clear to them without including the sort of gratuitous detail about yourself that I find very off-putting sometimes, and you can tell when a writer is doing something to make themselves look a certain way that's like not necessarily in service of the piece but in service of themselves as a character. So I try to stay away from that.
Does that present challenges to you as a writer, that sort of transparency? I mean, I'm thinking about like a certain kind of piece, it would be indistinguishable whether that Instagram incident and the Jay-Z incident, that one of them was like in person and one of them was like clearly secondhand. And by being so clear about it so early, you can't really go back. Like once you've announced your presence, you can't pretend that you were there at things you weren't there. A bunch of sort of doorways close off to you. Is that something that's been challenging you at all?
Well, I mean, I think, again, like with a character, not a character, with a human like him, you know, again, someone with so much baggage, I think you cannot pretend to be this omniscient. Like you are having your own personal reaction to this person as anyone else is. And hopefully your readers trust that you have been chosen to tell this story for a good reason. I don't know. I feel like I read a lot of third-person writing that feels fake to me, basically. It feels like it's kind of this patina of respectability. I mean, not always at all, but often I think things would just be more straightforward if acknowledged who was writing the story.
Do you have models for the kind of writing that you like that is sort of more transparent about those issues?
My very favorite profile of all time, if I could write something half as good, I would die happy. It's called Professional Doppelganger, and it's a profile of Sam Cohn or Kahn. I don't know how to pronounce it. He's an agent. It was written by Mark Singer in the 80s. And it's just this amazing profile of a guy who is behind the scenes making everything in Hollywood and Broadway happen. And he's, you know, this kind of larger-than-life figure, this nebbishy weird guy that can just accomplish ungodly amounts of things in a half hour. But people have reactions to him, and there's no way not to feel implicated in any reaction in any situation you are in with this guy. I think it's crazy to write a profile like that and not admit that how you yourself are affected by the person you're writing about. So that is always kind of the model to me.
Interesting. I don't really know that much about Mark Singer as like a person. He's a great writer. As the person you are in your physical vessel right now, what kind of reaction do you get from people? I was thinking about this. You send along a Harper's piece, which I think is not yet out.
It's out in May.
Out in May, where you go to a bunch of cattle auctions in Texas, which is a place that you're pretty far out of the New York City tap water. In sort of disclosing that, I think it's one thing where, like, I can imagine you in Ryan McGinley's studio, and like you don't look that out of place there, you know, like you could be like a friend of a friend.
Yeah.
But at a Texas cattle auction, you're going to stand out quite a bit more. I mean, what kind of reactions do you get trying to do an interview there?
There was absolutely no point in pretending I was anything but an outsider mm-hmm. there. I was the only woman there. I was younger than everyone there by 50 years. Like, it was just not, I mean, you either take advantage of your position or you're just going to fail, I think. So, I mean, I was very purposeful. I wore a sundress. I used all of these, like, potential disadvantages to my advantage, I think. I mean, again, it's, like, also flattering to have, like, some young girl from the big city there, like, interested in what we're doing. There's a certain element of just flattering the subject with your curiosity, which is true and is real.
Have you gone out on one of these more experiential pieces where you're sort of fishing and just come up empty before?
Yeah, I'm pretty good at, you know, cutting my losses earlier. I try to be, just for financial reasons. You can't really.
How do you know when you're chasing a dud?
It's hard. I mean, I would say, like, when something presents, when it becomes very obvious that something is an interesting topic, but there's not a story. Though that's a weird way to put it, because I feel like I write a lot of things that aren't necessarily stories. Either the piece needs to be larger than the subject at hand, or there needs to be a story. It's one or the other. It can't just be this interesting topic that is interesting for its own sake, but there's no one at the center. There's no narrative action. When it just becomes a matter of you're just going to keep describing it.
Yeah, I mean, that's
interesting. And you're just going to describe it. And at a certain point, like, who cares?
Well, and you're quite good at describing things. So I imagine that that's a dangerous tact to describe. It has to be an interesting story, or it needs to have an interesting person within it.
Yeah, it has to have an interesting person, or it needs to, you know, like the Sotheby's piece, for instance. You know, as you said, that was about something larger than just my experience at Sotheby's. So it needs to have that larger than itself quality, or it needs to be a story.
I hadn't actually really thought about this until right now, but a lot of these stories have to deal with the intersection of commerce and art.
I mean, art is hard to write about, I think, because artists usually are not good at talking about their work, and they don't want to. So interviewing them is kind of a lost cause often. And also, everyone who writes and talks about art is also a difficult person to interview, I find.
Well, you say something in that McGinley piece where he's at Yale and he's mm-hmm. talking to the students, and he says, like, no, don't use this, like, bullshit art talk. Just, like, talk the way you talk to your friends. And you describe the way that if you actually do that and act like you're at a skate park, you sound like a moron. And if you use the, like, catalog copy for an art thing, you sound like a person who's, like, translating French through Google Translate several times back and forth, and some of the words seem like they're made up. So when I was reading that, I was like, so what, as someone who's writing about art, how do you find, like, where is the language of the middle ground for a writer?
That's a really good question. I mean, you don't want to be too chummy, too bro-y, too anything ever. I mean, for me, it's just, I hate writing that doesn't make sense. I hate it. Of any sort. And there's a lot of it, and I just want every sentence I write to make sense.
Does that involve, like, a lot of sentence level work on
No, I think it's usually, most people think in a way that is logical. And then there's, like, a natural obscuring that goes on that I don't like.
Does that extend to, like, using quotations and that kind of stuff, and sort of naturally capturing people's spoken line?
Yeah, I love cut. I mean, that's always difficult too, right? I mean, everyone sounds terrible if you quote them, basically. It's very rare that someone speaks in full sentences, full paragraphs, says great things. Yeah, I mean, yeah, like, you put quotes around something and someone always sounds dumb, basically, unless they're someone who's very gifted.
So how do you compensate for that? Like, when you have a character and you're like, I know when I'm with this person, they have this quality, but then when I directly quote them, it's something different. I mean, that McGinley piece has very few quotes from McGinley in it. I don't know, maybe only a couple. Like, what do you try to capture when you can't capture someone's direct voice?
The way they say it, the way they look at you when they say it. I mean, the meanest, the cruelest pieces usually rely on the subject's quotes.
Yeah,
right?
Sort of let people hang themselves.
Hang themselves.
Yeah.
I mean, and I think that's really dangerously easy to do. If you quote anyone, they're going to sound stupid. So you really have to, I think, if you are going to be fair, you have to editorialize quite a bit. Almost to, I mean, sometimes to the exclusion of even quoting them.
Is that contentious, like with editors, that you do avoid sort of the direct quotation? That, you know, I think there's a certain fetishization of the direct quote.
Yeah.
And like, I didn't take out any of the ums.
Right.
In journalism.
I mean, it always seems like you're making fun of someone to me. Always, basically.
How do you, I mean, how, like, you said that you liked McGinley, ultimately, mm-hmm. that you had a respect for him. But let's say it went the other way. How do you avoid making fun of someone? I mean, how do you avoid that sort of natural conclusion?
I think I've gotten a lot better at it. I mean, the meanest writers are usually the youngest writers. I think once you are aware of the fact that people are actually reading you, you're going to become a lot kinder, or at least afraid of making enemies. I think you're also, there's a certain, maybe everyone should start their career with this assumption. I didn't. But there, for me, there was like a point, and I can't put my finger on it, but there was a point at which I realized, oh, the person you're writing about definitely is going to read this.
Yeah, 100%. It does not matter where you read. Like,
everyone's they're going to read it, and it's, I mean, it doesn't matter what kind of person, it's going to kill them. Like, why wouldn't it? And I feel like I had that realization too late.
What was it like? I know that you interviewed Renata Adler.
Mm-hmm.
Adler. I don't know why I said it that way. For The Believer.
Ooh. That's a good person, a person who's good at talking.
Well, yeah, I was going to say also, that's also a person who is like really mean in her youth. Like, what's, like, what is it like interacting with like someone, like you said that people are meanest when they're young. Like, what's it like interacting with how do you approach an interview with someone who's like super mean?
Well, she was super nice. I was very nervous. I had never been more nervous for anything. I drank beforehand. I was very, very nervous. I was just absolutely sure I was going to feel like an idiot. You know, I'd be super intimidated. And she just turned out to be the most charismatic, easy to talk to person. Like, in the way that charisma can be very creepy often. It does not surprise me that she's an amazing reporter.
And like, I mean, beyond the sort of baseline intimidation of interviewing an interviewer, which I am forced to confront near a weekly basis. I assume that having an interview with direct quotes and only like a little nice little header section where you get to do it, it sort of takes away all of the tools of that we've described that you
right.
do in these pieces. You don't get to change the quote and describe it. You don't get to sort of craft it in that way. What was that experience like?
Well, she was just such an amazing, she's such a good talker. That didn't even occur to me, to be honest. It was just, everything she said was great, fully formed.
What is a great conversationalist? I know like a few people personally who have that quality, and I personally know myself not to have that quality.
I definitely don't have that quality.
And I always wonder, because it's not necessarily like, I mean, it's connected to people being interesting, but there's a lot of interesting people who are kind of very difficult to talk to, actually.
I think it's more about being interested.
Interested.
Yeah. I mean, I know a few people who it's very obvious that they're good listeners and that they're listening when you're talking and are reacting, that they're reactive. I think that's usually what makes a good talker.
So
I also think, you know, it's about making the other person feel good. I mean, that's like that's literally what they taught at charm school.
Right? I did not go.
Me neither. But, you know, like make the person you're talking to feel good about themselves.
Right. And is that in some ways at a cross purpose with being a journalist or
yeah, you
reporting
have to like make
stories?
Sure you're not, you know, being influenced by your own ego, or if someone's making you feel great, that doesn't mean they're smart and talented, and I mean it can just mean they're charismatic. Yeah, I mean I think charisma is really tricky.
Do you try to charm people that you are doing when you're talking to them to a story? I mean, is that How do you feel as you like establish a chummy rapport or a certain connection with someone that you're writing about?
I mean, there's certain cases where the person, it's just very obvious very quickly that we're on the same page.
Yeah.
We'd be hanging out regardless. not that we would be hanging out, but, you know, were we to find ourselves in the same place, we'd be having a great conversation anyway. Renaud Adler was an example of that. Yeah, I mean, I think you have to kind of modulate your own personality depending on who you're talking to, whether you're talking to an old person, a young person, a man, a woman. I always feel like I'm not in control of my own personality as much as I would like to be. And if I could change one thing about myself, it would be to calibrate my reactions to things and change my personality at will. I think that's a really important skill for a reporter to have, and one that I don't feel like I...
What stands in the way of that for you?
I don't know. I mean, for me, it almost feels like a physical incapability. No matter what, my personality is the same, kind of.
I see that. So I see your byline pop up in strange corners of the internet all the time. You had a piece in the New York Times a couple of weeks ago about... tell me, what was the piece about?
It was about women who collect discontinued and hard-to-find nail polish.
So I assume that the time commitment for a piece like that is, like, radically different than, say, like, this Harper's piece, which I know you've had at work, been working on for months. How long does a piece like that take you? Just, like, a quick hit, I don't know.
The nail polish
piece? Yeah, 800-word Times piece.
I mean, like, the reporting itself, which was an hour or two on the phone and in person, and then writing it in a day, I guess.
So what's your ritual? What's your day-to-day like while you're doing some features, some little tinier pieces like this and really different places like N plus one and the New York Times all sort of mixed together?
I'm not very good at working on things all at once. I like to finish something, or I like to be able to get as far as I can with one thing before I start another, which is not always the most efficient way to work. But like, I'm not very good at working on multiple things in one day. Like, usually if I'm working on multiple pieces at once, I usually devote a day to this thing and then the next day to that thing. I'm not good at switching between them.
How many editors are you maintaining a relationship with to have this diversity of pieces coming out every month?
Oh, lots. I feel like there's the kind of, like, there's a writerly ambition where you want to get published in lots of places, and you want to write a certain kind of story, and you want to be able to write long things, and you want to be able to write for this publication and that publication. And at this point, as a freelancer, I think you kind of feel like an orphan and kind of like you don't have a home. And like, my goal is not, there's no publication that I want to publish in so much as I would like love to just have one of these like career long editor writer relationships. That just seems like a dream to me. I think those are rare and rarer now than they used to be, but that is so much more appealing to me than any other sort of goal. Like, that is the goal for me.
Like, you have an idea and then you decide where is the most appropriate place to take it? Or are you like, I need to do a Times piece, I got to come up with a Timesy-ish idea?
No, it's usually I have an idea and I want to figure out the best place for it. I mean, the thing is, there aren't very many options for any one thing. There just aren't. Like, it doesn't require a ton of mental juggling.
How do you know that, like, a piece on discontinued nails is, like, 700 words and a piece on Mavericks is 3,500 words or 5,000 words?
Well, I mean, I think the piece on nail polish could have been...
It could have been an epic.
Yeah, it could have been 5,000 words long.
It could be. I could see that being like a book in a way, because it's like there's no bottom to that. Like, there's, you're not going to get too deep. Like,
right.
It just keeps going down,
yeah,
down, down into a spiral. But what makes you say
it just didn't. It honestly just didn't occur to me that that piece could run anywhere else but the style section, who I already had an editor there, so that made sense. But and I know how long a piece for them would be. It kind of just naturally in my mind, the publication and the idea were kind of, you know, synonymous.
So is this volume that you're doing now, which to me seems like my brain would like spin into several pieces trying to do these much stuff simultaneously. Is this like a full-time load, like a living for you?
Yeah, it is. I mean, not a grand living, but a living.
Is it sustainable to work in this sort of a way?
I'd like to think so. I mean, I've never had a writing job. You know, I've never worked at a magazine. I've never been a staff writer. I've never had anything like that. So I don't really have a point of comparison. But for me, like, the hustle is very energizing.
And it's not difficult. Like, do you have trouble with like discipline and like being able to like treat it like a job when it is like so many small jobs with different people?
No, I'm good at that part. That part's not difficult for me. I mean, the difficulty in being a freelancer is feeling powerless, I think, and having no idea what is going on that's determining your work, basically. Like if someone says no to something, you have no idea why they said no. So there's like a lot of information asymmetry that you're dealing with all the time. I love when editors even just say like, our editorial meetings are on Thursdays. Like that's amazing. Like that changes everything. Like that makes it so much easier. Like I will not email you on Thursday or even Wednesday. Like I'll make sure to email you on Friday. Like that really is helpful.
When you imagine like taking like a staff job or like sort of locking into a more mono rather than poly employment situation, what would that like? Where would that take your work? Like, how would your work change if you were sort of locked into a single groove? And what would you like to pursue?
I mean, I definitely do not. I don't have a beat, but in in any sense whatsoever. So I don't think I would ever. I can't imagine anyone hiring me to write about one thing. I don't know what that one thing would possibly be in that editor's mind. I mean, ideally, it's like writing long things, basically being able to write one thing at a time or a few things at a time.
What you said about sort of being in the dark as a freelancer in those situations, do you have a community of people who are writing and doing this kind of stuff in New York? I mean, is there a lot of sharing of notes and that kind of thing?
Yeah. My best friend, who's been on this podcast, Molly Young.
Check out her podcast.
She has a full-time job, but she's also a freelance writer. And so we compare notes and share editors' email addresses and recommend each other for things and all that kind of stuff.
Is that a competitive difficult? I mean, is it hard doing the same thing with someone that you know so well?
No, I think it's really fun. I don't know. We're too close of friends for it to be I mean, I would imagine it definitely would be were we not already friends, such good friends. I mean, I think we're mostly just cheerleaders for each other.
I mean, your writing is very different. What's it like knowing someone that well, like knowing them as a child and really knowing like who they are and then seeing them sort of develop as like the writerly persona?
Oh, I think it's really fun to watch and really impressive and makes me proud. And, you know, we ask each other lots of questions and we're in touch a lot. So it's not usually a huge surprise when there's it's never a huge surprise when a piece exists from either of us, but it's also, we've talked about it a lot beforehand.
I imagine that at the clip that you're going at now, you're like burning through a lot of ideas because you're doing a lot of pieces. Do you like have sort of like a reservoir of things that you want to do? Do you have like a master file of stories?
I do, yeah.
You said that the Mavericks piece was something that you had wanted to go to it for a long time.
I don't have any, that was like a pretty like longitudinal interest. I don't have a ton of stuff like that I've been interested in for like literally a decade. But I mean, it's like, it's very, very, very nice when I remember something. I'm like, oh yeah, like that was something I wanted to write about that I emailed myself 2 years ago and I'm still interested in that. I love discovering that. That's very comforting to me because I don't think of myself as someone who's like very good at getting in front of things I wouldn't be naturally inclined to see. I mean, I think that's just a function of being someone who works at home, who has friends who basically do the same thing as I do.
If I were to describe like parts of your writing that I really like, it has some similarities to like travel journalism, except to be a travel journalist generally, which I don't even know if that profession really still exists, but like if you're Pico Iyer in the 80s, and my dad is buying your books obsessively, you're like on the road all the time, you know, you're just, things are happening to you and then you're writing about them and you can sort of continually thrust yourself into the unknown and then expect that you'll reap the rich fruits of human experience. But that does not work when you're sitting around Brooklyn in a coffee shop with six other writers.
No, it does not. I think there's certain tricks. I mean, I think like Twitter is absolutely pointless. A lot of people think they're going to get a story idea on Twitter.
I was hoping you were going to say Twitter is the secret.
No, God, no. I mean, if it's on Twitter, it's already a thing. Like everyone else has already seen it too. It's not really. I mean, maybe there's like trends in Twitter.
But so that's an interesting. So, okay, Twitter is not the place. But what, like, where do you have like dark corners of the internet or the world?
I have. Well, I mean, I think one thing, especially if you're young and kind of starting out, is you want to be able to pitch editors pieces that are going to be cheap for them to run. So, I mean, I recently pitched a story that would require me reporting it from a place that I could easily stay at my parents' house. And you have to be kind of strategic. Like I have AP alerts set for zip codes where I know I could, if a cool story came up, I wouldn't need to pay for a hotel.
How many zip codes does that cover?
You know, like three or four. Like if you have friends in cities, like, you know, I think.
Has that panned out? Like have you?
It almost panned out once, but I still think, I'm still hopeful that it will. And I think I've definitely, you know, like this Maverick story, it ended up running an N+1, but it could have I could have written it for a bigger place and could have sold it by the fact that they wouldn't have to pay for a hotel or a rental car or, you know. I think that's
Something you're like totally upfront about? Like, I've got a great pitch for a story and a great couch near it.
If I pitch a story and I can, and it's going to be cheap for them for some reason, I definitely tell them. I mean, they have budgets. It's not. One more trick. This is, I don't want to expose it too much, but the Boston Globe's national editor, whoever at that paper edits or like collates the AP stuff, is amazing. And there's just the weirdest stuff in there.
So this is the like the Boston Globe's like curation of the AP wire?
It's amazing.
I learned that a few years ago
and there was some cool stuff from there.
Right on. So once like, so you're on the Boston Globe AP wire. There's like a, there's a zip code that is in your hot spot and it pings and it comes across.
I book the next flight.
What interests you? Like, what is it that like sets off like your radar as for a story?
It's usually a story that I could imagine being fun to report and that there would be like a lot of, for lack of a better word, color, lots of fun things to see and people to talk to. But again, that it's some larger issue. Usually that doesn't need to be explicitly, I mean, it does in the pitch, I guess, but it doesn't necessarily need to be explicitly stated in the piece or it can be like implied. I'm usually attracted to weird places. Often that's kind of what perks my ears up, learning that there's this community of people in the middle of this state doing such and such. It's more often places than people, I think.
You actually said in that Mavericks piece, you describe the sensation of watching someone surf and someone come through a barrel roll, and you describe it as fun and a kind of fun that you personally had not experienced for a long time. And you compare it to sort of like a cliche idea of karaoke, someone doing karaoke, not your own experience with karaoke.
Not my own experience with karaoke.
A generic platonic ideal of the karaoke experience. You describe going through that thought process and realizing that you haven't had an experience like that in a period of years. And I wonder if reporting these stories is in some ways that experience for you. And you described like wanting to do something that was fun. What makes reporting a story fun for you? Like how do you make that experience happen for yourself?
It's interesting that you would put it that. I like this because I think thinking about it in terms of surfing is actually helpful. Yeah, like being a little bit scared and nervous. I don't know. It's hard to articulate. I think it's like this. Like there's this sweet spot of feeling as though you have a certain kind of like intellectual mastery over something, but also having no idea what it is. Being able to trust that you are going to understand something in like a very full and deep way, but not being there yet.
How do you keep having that experience? For, I mean, that's what they say about like, you know, like surfing. It's like at a certain point you got to like go like surf in like Costa Rica because you've like been in California too long or whatever. Like how do you have an experience like that that's quote unquote fun but not sort of repeat yourself, and how do you have it be a fresh experience each time with these?
Well, I think, I mean, that's like the best part about journalism, right? Is that it necessarily is going to be fresh every single time. You can think of journalism in, that's just a kind of a way of being in the world where you're allowed to talk to people and ask questions and be curious about things that everyone is allowed to do. You know, you can go into your deli and ask the guy where he's from and like why he's, that weird thing is on the shelf instead of the more generic version of it. And I mean, anyone can do that, but I think it's a real luxury to realize that it's your job to do that.
Thank you very much. Anything else we missed that we should be talking about?
Oh, I don't know.
You should definitely get this month's GQ for that profile of Ryan McGinley. You should be picking up a Harper's at some point in the somewhat near future, potentially. And you have a website that has pretty much all your stuff on it, and we will link to that in the show notes. Thank you again, Alice Gregory.
Thanks for having me.
And that was the Long Form Podcast. Thanks to my co-hosts, Evan Ratliff and Max Linsky. Thanks to Jenna Weiss-Berman for editing this show. Thank you to Sarah Button for interning this show. Thanks to Alice Gregory for coming on the show. Thanks to EA Sports, FIFA, World Cup, and Tiny Letter for sponsoring this show. We'll be back next week.
Why do you run? Why does anyone?
I always thought that runners loved running, and that's not the case. Most runners hate running, but they choose to do it.
In the new docuseries, Running Sucks, brought to you by Team Milk, Abby Ayers learns why women runners everywhere are driven to go the distance.
It really is about taking my power back and proving myself wrong.
Team Milk is about fueling women's performance and helping them along their marathon journeys. You can sign up now for the inaugural Every Woman's Marathon taking place in Savannah, Georgia on November 16th, 2024. Learn more and register at everywomansmarathon.com.